Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at the coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Everyone, Andy Richter here, podcasting yet again. I'm actually in the Conan O'Brien Memorial Studios.
Oh no! What happened? Where did he go?
Well, I don't know. He's just not here today. Okay, so it's fine. Memorial. We have to think about him in the past tense. And I want to tell you, this one today is not going to pass the Bechdel test because we are talking about Conan all the time.
Okay.
No, we aren't. Okay, I'm kidding. Good. No, I'm kidding because we're not really going to.
No.
But, you know, I mean, because
he might be more boring to the two of us than to anyone else.
I know. That's the thing.
Except maybe his family.
No, absolutely. That's the thing. And I do feel like, by the way, I'm talking to Liza Powell O'Brien. Who's here today to promote both her new podcast and her play.
Oh.
Isn't it?
That's over, but we can talk about it.
Oh,
sure.
But I mean, isn't it going to play? It's not going to run anywhere else?
Listen, if anyone out there would like to produce it, please contact me.
Well, I would, but I'm broke because somebody's show ended.
is that what happened?
Yeah, that's what happened.
No wonder.
No, but where were we? I was going to say something about what were we talking about? I lost it.
Conan.
Oh, about Conan. Right. No, because it is tempting to. Oh, you said about him being boring.
Right.
Yeah, to other people. Yeah, it is. I do feel in many ways. Like, I'm his TV wife. You're his real-life wife, and I'm his TV wife.
Yeah.
Because being with him for all those years definitely gave me, like, it made me very sympathetic towards the things that my ex-wife would go through at parties or out in the world.
Oh, interesting.
Of just kind of all this attention being on me and then her kind of a like, oh, hi,
right.
You know, to her and
right.
then me.
Right.
And that would happen. It was astounding. I mean, first of all, he's a parade float. He can't be incognito.
You know that one time, I think he's talked about this, but we were in Seattle in the winter where it gets dark at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And he would take these obsessively long bike rides in the dark, in the rain, maybe to escape my family, who can say?
Maybe to porno shops.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. And he was once on the bike with the helmet and, like, you know, glasses so that the rain didn't get in his eyes. And it was dark and he was maybe 50 yards away from a car. And he thought, well, now I'll be, you know, anonymous. Hey, Conan. Like, people driving by, just he is instantly recognizable.
Yeah, I don't know.
In a ski helmet, he can tell who he is.
And especially without a hat on, then he's really.
Well, forget that.
But there were so many people that used to say, come up, if he and I are out in the world, come up and say, I love the show. I watch it all the time. Can I get a picture with you? And then, okay. And then just like hand the camera to me.
Right. And you are.
Yeah. And I'd be like. In some ways I understand it because I can understand like the weird having experienced people meeting me and think and saying, you're Andy Dick.
Oh,
and like,
my God.
Well, and being like, what? How do you get, I mean, Right. And then realize it's just something with the name. Yeah. But then sometimes they really do think like, you're Andy Dick, you were on the Ben Stiller show or, right. you know, like,
right.
I don't.
And you're people, wrong if you try and controvert that, right? You're well, like, actually, no. They're like, no, you were.
They're just, well, sometimes, yeah, sometimes they're weird that way. But other times it's just the synapses get all mm-hmm. screwed up because they get excited. So I never took offense to it. And also, I'm fine with not a lot of attention. So, mm-hmm. I mean, and is that something you've, I mean, are you fine with mm-hmm. not a lot of attention?
Mm-hmm. I don't know what to do. The first time that I went to the Emmys with him in 2000, I was so nervous about being scrutinized because I'd never been in any kind of public view at all. And I got out of the car.
Was this when you're just dating?
Yeah, we were just
dating.
Are
you engaged or just?
No, just dating. Yeah. We've been dating like 4 months
or
something. Or I don't know, 6 months, something like that. And, you know, you get out of the car and there's that gauntlet of all the stands of the people screaming. And mm-hmm. I mean, I haven't been in a long time. I don't know if it's changed, but, you know.
Yeah, they're on bleachers.
They're on bleachers. And they're
in the hot sun.
And they're making a lot of noise.
Yeah.
And the photographers and all the handlers. And I instantly realized, oh, I could burst into flame, and not only would nobody notice, they certainly would not put me out.
Right.
Like, I am so beside the point here, and it was actually a great relief because when people say, like, what superpower would you love to have? I always wanted to be invisible. Like, that would have made me feel so comfortable.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was tall early, so I was not usually invisible. So in some ways, he's my invisibility cloak, which I love.
Yeah.
So I feel much less self-conscious around him.
Now, you're from Seattle.
I am.
The Seattle area or Seattle proper. Seattle proper. And kind of a fair you have a number of siblings, don't you?
Just the one.
Oh, just one.
Yeah.
Okay. And mm-hmm. older, younger?
Younger.
Younger. Mm-hmm. So, and what do your folks do? It's been COVID's been a long time.
Yes. My mother was a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
She's retired now. My father also retired. He was an insurance broker,
uh-huh.
but he's also a jazz musician.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fun combo.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I asked him once why he didn't, because he's quite good. And I said, why did you not, try to do that for a living? Because in our era, everyone's got a dream, everyone's
sure.
got passion, everyone's got a creative outlet. And he said, the day you have to get up and do the thing you love, you kind of stop loving it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And which may have just been a justification of need
could
the security
be.
Of an
right.
IRA. Or
right,
whatever.
Right. Yeah. What does he play?
He mostly plays guitar and uh-huh. banjo, but he can kind of play anything.
Oh my God. Do they get into jam sessions and stuff?
Well, it's Dixieland jam.
Oh,
so a little
okay.
less freeform.
Right, right, right.
But he does have friends who he plays with where they'll have musical conversations a little bit.
And, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Nobody else is involved.
Right, right.
We don't speak that.
Right. Well, and yeah, because Dixieland is
more structured than
it's structured, but it is like it's a jam. It is very
yes.
jammy. It's
yeah.
as jammy as a lot of rock and roll, as
yeah.
a lot of blues, but kind of like almost more difficult than most of those things. There's almost like a classical.
That might be
lots
true.
Of notes,
a lot of notes,
yeah.
and charts, and
uh-huh.
But there's something kind of courtly about it too. That they all take their turns, with their
yes,
solos,
yes,
and. I think that's such a cool tradition amongst all musicians in probably every, every genre.
Yeah, yeah.
When there's any kind of improvisation. But jazz, sometimes when I think of jazz, I think of bebop and, Charlie Parker or free music, free
yeah,
jazz,
yeah,
which
yeah.
is a whole other thing. And this is a little bit more like you have to know the standards and you mm-hmm. have to know who came before you and what the famous versions of it are and all that stuff.
Right.
But.
And you like play someone else's solo.
Right.
And you stick to the notes that whomever thought
I don't know about
it.
That, actually.
Oh, you don't know that? Yeah.
I
don't know.
I think they do.
I'm acting
they
like
do.
I know things.
Yeah,
it's
improv.
Served me well.
We could get them on the phone and solve this all just really, really fast.
Dixieland doesn't
Eduardo
test well.
Eduardo has worked with my father before because
oh, really?
Yeah, because in one of the episodes.
Eduardo's the producer, sound engineer here.
Yeah.
Whatever, Say you're a producer.
I'll tell you what you are. No, we were working on the Nabokov episode and Dan Bukatinsky, who voices Nabokov, wanted to do the accent, which is incredibly challenging because Nabokov had a really bizarre accent. But then he also, there was a poem that we were reading the translation of, and I wanted to underlay the original Russian of it. And Dan doesn't speak Russian. So my father, who majored in Russian in...
Oh, wow.
He got a master's degree in it, in Slavic languages. And so we got him on a Zoom so he could coach Dan on the sort of phonetic pronunciation of this Russian poem.
That's great.
But the best part was I texted my dad and I said, would you be available for this? It was like 9:15 in the morning. He said, I'm about to start eating breakfast. How about noon? I was like, first of all, why are you eating breakfast 2 hours and 45 minutes? Also, I'm on the Zoom with the actor who's doing this job for us. I'm not going to say, could you come back in 2 hours? So he ate quickly, I guess, and was able to join us before
we
wrapped up.
He wolfed it down in an hour.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Did you know my dad taught Russian?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, my dad, he's retired now, but yeah, he taught Russian and at Indiana University.
Oh, wow.
For 30 plus years.
Did he ever live there?
He would go every year with a group. From even, pre-breakup of the Soviet Union days, he started and he would go every summer with a group of students and they would study for a while and then they would travel the rest of the time. So he's done lots of traveling.
That's so
he's
cool.
He has a lot of friends there. And his specific focus was phonetics. And he said that when he was I'm taking his word for it. But when he was in Russia, that he said only his clothes would give him away as a non-native speaker.
Wow.
And that lots of people wouldn't believe that he was a non-native speaker. Yeah.
So where was he born in America?
Yeah, he's from Springfield, Illinois.
Uh-huh.
And
he went the great Slavic outpost.
Exactly. And he's, the German and French.
Uh-huh.
His dad's German, his mom's French. And American. They're all, from coal miners.
Wow.
Because Central Illinois had a bunch of strip mines for many years. And he started school and he was in, he was doing choral music. And so he was a music major at DePaul University in Greencastle, Indiana, and told me that he got there and hated music majors. Didn't want to be around music majors, found them to be pretentious bores. Huh. So he dropped out. Was going, I think, to community college back in Springfield and decided that he better join the Army before he was drafted. So he
what year
tested.
Is this?
This is in the 50s.
Uh-huh.
He took the aptitude, the language aptitude.
Yep.
It was just past the Korean War because he didn't have to go to war.
Okay.
And he took an aptitude test and scored incredibly high in language. And so they sent him to Monterey, to the language school. It's a big military language school. And he said it was the most beautiful place that he'd been, that he was like, studying which language will keep me here the longest? And they said, Russian or Chinese? And he said, okay, Russian. Chinese seemed too daunting.
Uh-huh.
And it gave him his vocation.
That is fascinating.
And kind of his avocation, too, because he's a published author of definitive phonetic texts of Russian songs for English singers, Rachmaninoff songs. Oh, incredible niche. I have them all at home in my shelf and it's but apparently they're indispensable.
He owns that.
Yeah.
He's the guy.
If you're an English speaking opera singer and you need to sing some Tchaikovsky songs, who knew they were Tchaikovsky songs? You got to get his book. So,
that's fascinating.
So he taught Russian for many, many years. And
is
so
that
I
the
grew
only
up,
language that he learned besides English?
He understands a number of them. Like most of the Slavic languages, he can understand. He's sort of basically conversant in. And he can hear German and understand it. And French too.
There was a great piece in the, I feel like it was in the Washington Post about this guy who's a super linguist because they're studying his brain.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like a vacuum repairman or something.
Yeah.
But he has this incredible facility, and he speaks 11 languages just for fun. He just picks them up.
Yeah.
And he's studying more.
Seems so exhausting.
I know, but also, like, talk about a superpower.
Yeah, no kidding.
That is cool.
I know. I just, you know, I wasted all mine on, like, French and German. Like, why didn't I do Spanish?
Listen, you know, I'm mortified that I don't speak Spanish living in Southern California.
I know. It would make life so much easier and fun and enriching. And, you know, I mean, I guess I could do it now, but, you know.
It's harder now.
Well, there's 30 other fucking things on that list that I that I don't do. That on a daily basis, I yell at, I'll get to that later. You know, when I grow up.
My high school didn't even offer Spanish as a language.
No shit. What did
Isn't that crazy?
What was it? Is it a public school or?
No, it was a private school, and I think it was a class thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They had Latin and Japanese and German and French, and I don't know if they had anything else, but no Spanish.
Of course. Yeah, no. And, this, you know, why would they?
I wonder if they've changed that.
We'll probably. Yeah, who knows?
Put that on your list. Go find out.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places. Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Meet the next generation of podcast stars with SiriusXM's Listen Next program, presented by State Farm. As part of their mission to help voices be heard, State Farm teamed up with SiriusXM to uplift diverse and emerging creators. Tune in to Stars and Stars with Issa as host Issa Nakazawa dives into birth charts of her celeb guests. This is just the start of a new wave of podcasting. Visit statefarm.com to find out how we can help prepare for your future. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
Well, what kind of kid were you when you were younger? Mm-hmm. Were you, I mean, you said you grew tall.
Yeah, I was taller early.
And that is, like, it's incredible how some of those things can be so formative on your personality, you know?
And there are people who are desperate for attention, and those are usually not the ones who are born tall early. I was self-conscious. I mean, it's funny because my mom, being a therapist, would talk about people's psychology a lot. And I think because she would never talk about my psychology to me, because that would be weird. So I just didn't think it applied to me in this way. And I remember thinking when I was like six, I wonder, because she was talking about someone's personality. And I was like, I wish I had a personality. I just thought I was
someday,
so
hon.
Boring.
Yeah.
And maybe I was boring. I don't know. But I was a kid who really loved to act as grown up as possible, not in like fast ways, but I remember being three and sitting next to my preschool teacher at the like playground, and everyone else is playing on the playground, and I'm sitting next to her trying to like copy the way that she's crossed one leg over the other and like looking at what she's wearing and like, oh, I'd like a blouse like that, you know. And I remember asking her how old she was, and I think she was 33 or something. I was like, yes, that is the perfect age. I mean, what a weirdo. Who, when they're three, wants to be a fully grown adult?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, enough of this business on the playground. Yeah. I'd like some keys and I'd like a bank account.
I kind of get that, though.
Like responsibility.
I couldn't get out of childhood fast enough.
Really?
Because I was just so, I think, so aware of the powerlessness of it all. And the lack of respect that you're afforded as a child.
Right.
You know, like, what you want, who fucking cares? Right. Do as you're told, you know? And I just couldn't wait to get out of that age. And also, just, you're such a slave to, like,
everything.
This tempest of emotions and hormones and madness, you know?
Everything seems so crazy.
Yeah.
I know. I try to remember that when I was in my 20s, actually, when I met Conan, I had been taking cello lessons. I played the piano, but I had always loved the cello. And mm-hmm. I was stuck with the piano because that's what we had, right? So I couldn't play the cello. So I took it up when I could in my 20s and then moved to New York City from Seattle and did not have a cello to bring with me. And it was actually the first gift Conan ever gave me was a cello.
Oh, wow.
Incredible. But anyway, I started taking lessons in New York City. And so I'd work all day and then I would come home and I would schlep my giant cello around the Upper West Side to the, you know, apartment of this guy who had been like first chair in the symphony or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And spend an hour with him trying to learn this instrument that I had never played. And I got home and I was like, no wonder you're exhausted as a kid. This is what you're doing on every front. You're learning everything all the time.
Yeah.
And I realized like, oh, I can't do that and have a job and, you know, be a grown up person. And I don't remember why I started talking about that.
Well, no, it just, you know, processing the information of music is, yeah.
It's a lot.
It's exhausting.
Yeah.
And I was going to say, because what we were saying was about kind of the tempest of youth.
Yes.
And because you brought it up again, and I wanted to get back to it. Having a therapist mom sounds like it could be beneficial or a freaking nightmare.
Well, I'll just say that the strangest person I've ever met had two psychiatrists for parents who were divorced and remarried to psychiatrists. So he had four psychiatrists as parents.
And oh, my
truly
goodness.
Truly bizarre. So that's the joke, of course. But,
yeah,
you know, I think in a lot of ways it's very lucky because, you know, she was also particularly interested in child psychology. So she was very focused on making sure that kids, you know, kind of you can buffer some of what you're talking about in terms of everything being out of your control and overwhelming and, you know, stuff happening in your body that you don't understand. And she was very sympathetic to all of that. And then there comes a point where you can navel gaze too much, you know, and you can sort of wonder about the you of it all too much. And I think I might have fallen into that trap a little bit. Not it wasn't her fault, but I did come with this sort of assumption that psychology is at the root of everything and that it just fixing that or thinking about that or talking about that is the way to make everything better. And, you know, it has its limits. So.
Right. Of course it does. Yeah. I relate so much having been to, a gazillion hours of therapy, you know, between that and private school. I'd have a freaking beach house and a boat if I hadn't spent money on all of those things.
But instead, you have a pristine inner psyche.
I'm totally perfectly put together.
Yes,
I mean that's right. It's obvious. Just spend 3 minutes with me. I mean that guy's got it going on. You know, I mean he can't put down the fork, but besides that, everything's great. No, because it is like my mom was really open to therapy and encouraged our, you know, we went to like family counseling, which just got me in the process of being comfortable with the talking cure, as they call it. But it's like the same thing that you say, like somebody that had two psychiatrist parents, like to me, I think when psychiatrist, like, because I've known some pretty cuckoo kids of shrinks and a couple, you know, like couple three. And it struck me as like the way sometimes, and I think it's probably more a romantic fictional notion, but how kind of like cops can easily go to the other side to crime. Like they're attracted to crime.
Right.
And they decide to be on this side of the business, but they could easily break through to the other side to where you're committing the crimes.
Yeah.
And I feel like with craziness, that's with shrinks. They're like attracted to craziness.
Right.
And it's because like, well, yeah, because
they have it.
Yeah. You also have, you're a mental criminal, you know,
that's right.
You inflict it on your children. Yeah.
No, and I think, I mean, there's probably a lot to be broken down to between which type of mental health professional you choose to become. And a psychoanalytic social worker, which is what she was to me. And again, I might be a little biased, but seems sort of like I want to be well-informed and helpful, but I don't necessarily want to, you know, mess with your brain chemistry or, you know, the psychiatrists that I've known and that she's known, some of them are amazing, brilliant people, and some of them should be in jail, you know, and I mean, I guess that's true probably of any profession, but I bet you there's a higher percentage of psychiatrists who are reprehensible. Let's find out. Add it to your list.
It's got to be there has to be a bit of a God complex to it.
Right.
You know, because you are really getting in there and stirring around in people's brains and, you know, and scraping the sides of the bowl. And But you also have like the gravitas of a medical degree, and that means you know everything, and you know,
right.
You're not just like, you know, like a psychologist is more just kind of like a sensitive person that read a lot of books,
right.
You know, I mean, I guess a shrink is the same thing, but it's, you know,
yeah,
it does. It just has more.
And I think there's a lot of, there are a lot of hierarchies within that, that genre of medicine too.
Yeah.
Actually my mom, I think, wanted to become a psychologist and went to,
you mean a psychiatrist?
No,
or?
I think she's, cause she's a, she has an MSW. So
oh, okay.
She's not a psychologist. And I think she was going to apply and she went and was either pregnant or had me with her or something. And the person who ran the school of psychology was like, no, this is not for like the breeder. This is not for a young woman. You belong over in social work. And she kicks herself for having listened to that person.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, I think she did all right. So,
well, yeah. And I mean, helping people is helping people. It just, you know, I mean, you're still, because my aunt was and had an MSW and was a counselor. And, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you're still kind of doing the same thing.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, I wouldn't even really be able to know, you know, in terms of like functional differences, I wouldn't even know what it would be, you know?
Right.
It's like,
right.
You know.
Right. Well, yeah, I think the billing is where you see
the
difference.
Yeah. Did you take a kind of, and I don't want to jump fully ahead to motherhood, but did you take a psychological approach to motherhood?
Debilitating degree. Yeah.
Did you really?
I was far too concerned with, I realized at one point, maybe 3 months in, and we had our first kid did not sleep. She woke up every 45 minutes.
Real asshole.
Such a dick. It was not pretty.
Yeah. I remember it at the time.
No, yeah. I mean, poor Conan was, he didn't know, because his mother had six kids with, you know, I was just with a friend whose stepdaughter has a baby and is having another one. And she said, there's so many specialists now. It's mm-hmm. like the breastfeeding specialist and the sleep specialist and the, you know, the, like you can hire specialists to help them learn how to grip the pencil when they're in preschool so they get into the better kindergarten, whatever. So, yeah. Ugh. So the antithesis of that is the, you know, Irish Catholic mother of six.
Right. Hand the infant to the 9-year-old and say, take care of them.
Totally.
Yeah.
And don't complain ever.
Right.
This is your duty and your gift. And,
yeah.
You know, you will perform it and offer it up to God. And so, and I was from this sort of hothouse flower environment of, you know, the joke in my house was that my mother would say, oh, sweetie, whenever anything was at all unpleasant for me or my sister or my father, just like, oh, I stubbed my, oh, sweetie, you know,
yeah,
oh,
yeah.
I didn't, I got the wrong kind of milk by mistake at the grocery store. Oh, sweet, you know, it's just maybe a little overdone empathy.
Like patronizing to a certain point?
No,
or,
she truly was, I'm so sorry that happened, you know.
Yeah.
And I sort of thought like, oh, well, I love my mom. She's a great mom. So that's how you're a good mom. And so when you have a squalling infant, you're like trying to empathize and make it better. That doesn't work so well. And there's a healthy degree of self-preservation that has to come into the mix. And that that was very hard for me to find.
Yeah.
I had to have that sort of beaten into me, and I had to have my husband say, like, this is not working the way that you're doing it.
Yeah.
And
nobody's benefiting from this dynamic.
Yeah, this idea of, like, every time she cried, I thought I was supposed to make it better. And I was supposed to, you know, I finally realized, like, I'm acting like her host here on Earth. Like,
yeah.
I am your host. I will show you an excellent time. Always. Like, that is not sustainable.
right.
So I had a lot to learn.
There's also a big difference between the first and the second, because
true.
My ex-wife and I used to, you know, with our first kid, he was colicky for a while and you know, was up, and it was
rough.
And, I mean, you know, you're not in a gulag or anything, but it's, you know, it's a basic form of torture, sleep deprivation.
That's right.
So yeah, that's, you're being tortured.
That's right.
And we were very macho about, we're going to do this ourselves. Mm-hmm. We're not going to just throw money at a problem and hire somebody. And by the time, and we waited 5 years to have another kid.
Mm.
And when she came around, we're like, get a fucking nurse in here. We're sleeping, you know, like, and of course, she's,
it's all fine.
Yeah. She's arguably better put together than the first one.
Because she wasn't absorbing the angst and resentment.
Well, I mean, I'm kidding. You know, they're different. You know, it's apples and oranges with every kid pretty much.
Yes. Well, that's the other thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
The chemistry between the parent and the kid is different each time.
Yeah. And they come out 3/4 of the way baked.
Right.
You know, like I thinking about looking at my children while they're still wet from being inside their mother, and realizing, like, from the look on their face,
it's the same
they're
person.
The same goddamn person, you know? They're the
right.
same sort of, they have the same attitude,
That's
the same
right.
sort of, like, you know.
Energy.
Yeah, energy mm-hmm. that they interface with the universe mm-hmm. with, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
Well, when you're in school, what were you sort of hoping to be?
I thought I was going to be a therapist or psychologist.
Yeah,
I was really interested in that. And then...
To please your mother, do you think?
No, because I was interested in the brain, and I liked what she did and respected it and thought I would be good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably wouldn't have been terrible at it, but... in my sophomore year, I was reading a Gabriel Garcia Marquez book in this beautiful reading room in the library. And I was like, this is all I want to do. Oh, wait, that's what you want to major in.
Yeah,
so
I
chose English as my major. And then when I graduated from college, I knew I wanted to write and I had to get paid for it, which narrowed things down considerably.
Yep.
And so I picked advertising because I thought I could never get into, you know, TV writing or film writing. I just completely wrote that off as inaccessible.
What about in journalism?
I'm terrible at research, which is why it's so ironic that I now have created a podcast that is so research heavy. But the internet has changed that. I have to say, if I had to do all my research in the field, like going to libraries or talking to other humans, that it would not happen. But the internet makes it a lot easier. So, journalism was out. No, I'm not in. I'd rather, I can't get the facts right, so I have to make them up.
Because I started out, I went to University of Illinois, and there I was heading towards the College of Communications, which it starts in your junior year. Mm-hmm. So I just had 2 years there of liberal arts and sciences. And then I had a meeting with a dean there who I told her what I wanted to do. And she's like, you should go to film school. You shouldn't be here. She said, because we'll teach you how to be a reporter. And I was like, yeah, because I don't care about
that's right.
Not other stories.
Nope.
I only care about fake stories that either I or somebody else makes up. I don't want, you know, and I also kind of like was looking forward as being Midwestern and practical, looking
right.
about like, what are the first steps of that? It'd be like reporting on, you know, I don't know,
Green
the price
futures.
Of corn
that's
or
right.
something, you know, and like, no, thanks. No, I don't want to do that. So.
So wait, did you go to film school?
I did. Oh. I transferred. I finished out my junior year there. And I had no intention. I was going to go to U of I for four years, but they didn't really have a film program. You could kind of patch together.
Could film the corn.
Well, you could patch together something in like the College of Fine Arts. But that wasn't the kind of film that I was interested in anyway. And I looked around and there was, you know, I thought, yeah, film school. And so I started to look and I ended up going to Columbia College in Chicago, which is a private arts college. Now, like a big going concern. At the time, it was sort of like an elevated trade school.
Well,
yeah,
I mean,
that's what it is.
Yeah,
exactly. And its competition in town was the Art Institute. But, you know, that I mean, they were kids doing, you know, hour and a half movies of leaves falling kind of stuff.
Right.
And that, again, I
the Chicago
was,
new wave.
Yeah. And I mean, and I was Chicago practical.
Right.
I was like, how am I going to get a
Tell
job?
A story.
And
yeah.
there was a lot of film production. There still is a lot of film production. And again, but again, it was advertising. That was
interesting.
Almost everything I worked in was advertising.
Yeah.
And I think if you know, show business hadn't worked out or if I'd been too scared to say yes to certain things, I'd probably be writing ad copy and producing television commercials today.
And you'd have a lot more money.
I very well may, you know, but I mean, no, I can't.
A lot more therapists.
I've had, well, but I've also, I mean, it would be doing the same thing, but I had a lot less constraints on me.
Right.
You know, I got to be way silly just for silliness sake, as opposed to like be silly to sell, you know, Dash or whatever.
So what did, this is not the way this is supposed to go, but I'm curious.
I don't care.
So good. So
we just got to fill an hour. However
okay,
we do it is up to
That's
us.
That's great.
Yeah.
It's my favorite kind of expectations. None. So you go to film school, you start in advertising, and then how do you get into like proper comedy?
Well, I finished film school and I had an internship at a production company that did commercials. Then I started working freelance in commercials, did a little bit of everything, started out as a PA, ended up pretty much primarily in props, which I enjoyed immensely.
Sorry about Bill.
Yeah,
by
the way. Bill Tall, our the show's prop master, just passed away yesterday.
This morning, I thought.
Yes, yesterday. Yeah, it was yesterday. And so props right now is a sad subject. But I had an affinity. I mean, Bill was a wonderful guy and his partner, John Rao. I used to spend tons of time back in the prop room back at Rockefeller Center because it was in the bowels of the building. And only partially because at the time I smoked you couldn't smoke in the building. Because when I started there, you could smoke anywhere in that building.
Wow.
So crazy to think that within my lifetime, there was a time when people would walk down the halls of an office building, smoking cigarettes everywhere.
Planes, too.
Yeah,
doctor's
planes.
Offices.
When Sarah and I went on our honeymoon in 1994, we were on a plane where people were still smoking cigarettes in the back, which is bananas. Because you get all
Never
smelling like
sense.
Smoke no matter what, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I've noticed lately there was somebody, I was at my kid's school and I was at the far end of the gym. And I could see out the open back door, somebody had lit up a cigarette 20 feet past the door. And I was seeing them put the lighter away and I could smell it.
Yeah.
Like, it's just so crazy. So I used to hang out with them all the time, but also because I knew props. Like, I had ended up in that line of work. And It's the most fun job on the set. You get, you have like a crazy hoarder's closet full of weird junk.
Yeah.
And in production sense, they'd send you out to just buy stuff. So you get this kind of like vicarious consumption thrill of they put $3,000 in your pocket and say, you know, you're propping out a dentist's office.
Well, go and especially buy stuff, on a show like Late Night where it's silly props.
Absolutely.
Like you can't get silly enough.
You gotta be right.
And I wondering about the sort of molding of my children's minds when we used to go visit their father at work and we'd walk down the hall and invariably there would be the craziest shit in the hallway. And they're just with the saucer eyes taking it all in.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, what is that going to do? It's probably good. You know, it's like stretching their understanding of just they can accept all sorts of weird stuff
because
they've seen it forever. But
well, and it makes the world seem magical, too.
Yeah,
I think,
absolutely.
Too. You know, like there is like, yeah, like, I always love the idea. I mean, in, you know, it's kind of in like Pee-wee's Big Adventure, you know, there's like somebody dressed as a Roman guard and somebody dressed as a spaceman and somebody is dressed as Marie Antoinette. And
it's no big thing.
And it's no big thing. And that's, you know, that's the lunchroom. And that was always the picture you had. And what I loved about our show was that at Warner Brothers, if a cowboy or a robot went to the commissary, it was probably from our show.
That's right.
You know, like it was like if there was somebody, you know, dressed up like the Pope.
Uh-huh.
They were working for us, you know.
Or a bear.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember, I feel like there was a camel in the hallway one time when we came by.
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. But yeah, then I worked in props and then I started taking improv classes in Chicago and then that just kind of organically grew to, you know, a show that we started, went on the road and went to New York and went to L.A. and, you know.
And do you feel when you're doing improv, do you feel sort of calmed in a way that nothing else does for you? Do you have that experience?
No, I don't. Well, first of all, I'm very, very rusty from improv. You know, I mean, not from improv. I'm rusty in my improv skills. And I'm not a true believer like many people are in terms of that they want to still. I can take or leave improv.
But you do it. Like, I'm just thinking, I mean, the way that Conan talked about working with you was sort of like you put him at ease instantly the first time that you guys had a conversation and started, I think you were playing already, just having a
Robert
conversation.
Robert Smigel, the first time he did an on-camera test, which was just to basically look at him.
Yeah.
Like, there was nothing even planned. It was just it was on Bob Costas's later set, and Robert said, "Hey, go sit by him, keep him company." And I didn't know if he. I'm sure he was at that. It was a. I throughout that entire process, I had no idea like that it was an audition, and like I mean, I just was like, they said go do this, and I just kind of there's a simpleness to me of like, okay, and it makes sense. Yeah, go talk to him, keep him company, because oh, that son of a bitch needs keeping company. Leave him to his own devices.
he'll bolt.
Yeah, yeah.
He's the highest strung thoroughbred.
But he, but you know, like Jeff Ross at one point. After we'd been doing test shows, said to me, "Well, you got the job," and I was like, "I thought I already had the job." Oh, no. Oh shit! I, you know, good thing I didn't know. I mean, not that it would have made a big difference, but I just, I mean, I just kind of, I always just take people at their face value, and I mean,
that's improv. I don't know. I mean, not to overascribe to it, but do think that there's a just because I get so anxious about. I think that's, anyway, how my social anxiety presents is like, what if something happens and I don't know how to respond?
Right.
But that in improv is that you just don't worry about that. Mm-mm. Like, you can't.
It's a practice. I mean, you have a facility for it to begin with. But then you over practice, you get kind of used to it. Because, I mean, I was just talking about this the other day. I, you know, I was on a TV show for a million years that would go out, you know, on TV and never sweated it. I mean, beyond the initial sort of getting used to it period, which I don't even remember how long that was, whether it was months or years. But, you know, doing that show was like going, you know, if somebody said, come down to my office and I want to chat with you, it was the same sort of like, okay, yeah, here we go.
Show not a heavy lift.
Music, here we go. Let's, you know, I'm going to exist in this moment and and be myself and have fun. And, but you know, later in life, and I mean, going and saying, like, somebody says, come do this improv thing in front of 40 people in a little black box on Franklin Avenue, and I am nervous, and I don't, you know, it's kind of, I have a lot of friends who are still into improv, and I was like, I don't... My thing, and I just said this the other day on this podcast, that I would just felt like, why would I leave the house to go get nervous somewhere? You know, like, if I'm going to leave the house, it's going to be for something fun that I really enjoy. And like, the last time that I did a full long form improv show, it was thrown at me at the last second. So I didn't have a lot of time to think about it. I did fine. I did well. I did not feel like, oh shit, I really sucked and people have an expectation from TV guy being good. I did very fine. But after it was done, I was like, oh, I'm not going to doing that for a long time.
I mean, part of that obviously is just as we get older, it gets harder to imagine leaving the house. But and you're more aware.
Your brain isn't as supple.
No, your brain isn't as supple. But I wonder if it also has something to do with this era of heightened attention, you know, like everybody's under scrutiny, and the fear that may have not been present in a different era of accidentally saying something that could maybe go the wrong way.
That doesn't enter into my thing. Okay, my thing is just the embarrassment of not being good on stage in front of people who have come to see a show. And it's weird too, because why those stakes should be higher than
television
on TV. And that I think is just a question of comfort.
Right.
I have, you know, I'm attached to rooms in terms of my comfort, like going in our studio. I could do that at Largo. I could do that. There's different places where I'm very comfortable and just kind of, but in a new setting, it can be kind of nerve wracking. Yeah, it can be nerve wracking. And even then, I don't even know when it's going to hit me. I don't even know when I'm going to be like, oh shit. But it also too, it's a brainwashing that you do on yourself of, compartmentalizing your focus onto just doing this thing and not worrying about what's happening
outside.
That gets
harder as you get older.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, it's a thing you process and get to. So, so advertising,
yes.
How was that for you?
A lot of it
and
was
what
great.
Took you? Did you start in Seattle in advertising and move to New York?
Yep. And Seattle was actually it's actually a great. I don't know if it still is, but it was a great town to do advertising in because.
Oh, really?
San Francisco, Austin, Boston, and Seattle at that time were all similar in that they had a relatively creative kind of. Predisposition almost. There's a lot of creativity in those places. And then
smaller agencies,
smaller
probably.
Businesses.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you were more often dealing with the person who was empowered to make the decision.
Oh, I see.
And so when I moved to New York, just because I wanted to live in New York and I didn't want to go there for advertising, but I did want to go
that's
there.
That's the way.
So
yeah.
That's the way. And it was so much more bureaucratic and so many, you know, big accounts that you would just pitch and pitch and pitch and pitch and pitch and never. My partner and I called ourselves the Queens of Cardboard. We just kept pitching ideas and even if they liked them, be like, yeah, okay, we got to get 17 other people to sign off on this. And you're like, well, then it's never going to happen. Yeah. So I got very frustrated with that part of it. But when I was first doing it in Seattle, I did a lot of radio spots in the beginning, which is great. They had Nordstrom as a client, my agency, and they ran radio spots all the time. And so it was just the new people got put on that. And TV were the big plum assignments. So people cared less about radio, but I loved it because there were little, you know, minute long radio theater dramas that, so I got to, I learned a lot about writing dialogue. I learned about ideas and how to present an idea in creative
economy,
form.
I imagine too.
Definitely that. And joke writing, not that I'm good at joke writing, but like something can seem really funny in a small room and then you take it to a bigger room and other people are involved and suddenly it's not funny and you have to, you know, I don't know how to explain any of that, but you get a crash course in it when you're doing those things.
Yeah.
So that was, and then I got, so I did it for, I think like 8 years and, it was a good job. It was a really good job. But then I was getting really frustrated and I really wanted to write fiction. And so I applied to graduate school and,
where at?
I applied to, I wasn't really sure if I wanted to stay in New York. I decided to kind of try my luck with New York because mm-hmm. it's hard to live in New York, period. But mm-hmm. if you're living in New York while you're in graduate school and not earning
anything, you gotta have money.
That's
yeah.
not gonna help. So it was a little bit torn. Happened to meet my husband right at the right time. So that was lucky. So I was able to make that change. But I applied to the New School. I applied to Sarah Lawrence. I applied to Columbia. I don't think I applied to Iowa because that's the big one, but I didn't want to move to Iowa. So I got into all of those programs, and I chose Columbia,
mm-hmm.
And loved it. I mean, going to graduate school after you've been in the working world for almost a decade is beyond exciting and like you can't, and people are skipping classes and some people come right from college and they're still in that mode. They're skipping. You're like, what are you talking? Why would you ever not want to come be here? It's so amazing. I'm only talking about stuff I'm interested in. I don't have to go to meetings about, I don't have to keep a time card. I don't have to talk to client, like all that shit. So, I really, really loved it. And I did a little bit of teaching as part of it, which I loved too. And then, had our kids and was still finishing my thesis. And then finally, when I was done with that, you know, we had little kids and we were moving here. And so writing got shelved for a little while.
But you've written a number of plays.
So then when I started writing again,
plays from fiction?
I moved out of New York City and started writing plays because that's the way you're supposed to do it, right? Get out of the mecca of theater and start trying to work in theater.
You should go back to writing ad copy just for fun.
Right, exactly. So I, when our younger kids started all day school, I finally had, which is in 2000, we moved here in 2009. So I think it was 2011. And I finally had time. And I was like, oh my God, I have to write something. And I wanted to write something of some kind of length because I had written short stories mostly. And I was like, that's so insubstantial. And I'm not really sure I ever write a good one anyway. And a novel is still kind of beyond my reach. I don't know how people can conceptualize and then complete a novel. That's a lot. But I was like, a play's like 75 pages. I feel like that's doable somehow.
And there's lot of blank space on the page when you're putting dialogue down.
And it's a lot of dialogue. And I'd taken a playwriting course at Columbia as an elective with Ellen McLaughlin, who was the, she's one of Tony Kushner's muses. She was the original Angel in Angels America. And she's this phenomenal theater artist and teacher. And it was my favorite class that I took the whole time I was in grad school. So I was like, and plays start from conflict and argument. So I was struggling with something in my head and I was like, I can't get over this thing. I keep kind of having this argument in my head. Maybe I should write a play about it. So that was what I did. And it was really bad, that play. But I wrote it. I wrote the whole thing. And that was the beginning of writing plays.
Yeah.
So I've been doing, you know, workshops and festivals. And I've said to people, I would love to go back to grad school and get an MFA in theater, but that's not happening. So I'm trying to cobble together my own MFA.
Why do you think it's not happening?
Well, I mean, when I was trying to do it, I had younger kids.
They're kind of bigger.
Now they're older.
Yeah.
Well, now I might be able, maybe. I don't know. It also, I think at a certain point, you get enough practical experience that it takes the place of what grad school would offer. But at that time when I knew nothing, not that I know much now, but I know a little bit more than nothing. It's like running away to join the circus. And I had kids who were under 8, so that was not happening. Also, that job that you guys had was a real organizer. Like, that job was so inflexible, the schedule, and it dictated so much where you live, how often you can leave where you live, when you get to be home, how much you need to sleep before you go back to the place where you do the job. Like, we kind of organized our whole life around the demands of that job, and that changed really recently. So we're still kind of, I think, sorting through what is possible now.
Yeah.
That you don't have to be at the studio 5 days a week.
Right, right. And you get more than, you know, 2 weeks off at a time.
Oh, yeah. When we went on our, when we got married, it was one of those, that was back in the NBC days. And so that was one of those winter breaks. Like, you guys never got more than 2 weeks off at a time.
And we, and not, and only in the summertime, only like in August.
Yes.
And which is like when my, I took my family to Japan once.
Right.
Which was a fantastic trip. But going to Japan in August is like going to Tampa in August.
Right.
Is, you know,
but that's when you have the time to make that turnaround.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So we did it in January and it was a week long break. And so he had to get, we did it in Seattle. So he had to get to Seattle for the rehearsal dinner, the rehearsal, the wedding, the whatever. And then we had our honeymoon. It's like, okay, now you got to go do that and then check that box before you get back to New York to be back on, you know, on the set. So I remember the first time that we had 3 weeks off in August. I mean, Conan used to say, like, I wonder what it's like to have 3 weeks off. I wonder what it's like, which is, by the way, like, join the rest of the population.
Yeah,
like, nobody, who gets three weeks off?
Well, and also, I mean,
you
my
a lot
feeling,
of weeks during the year.
Yeah, my feeling with him sometimes is like, I bet you could swing it if you pushed it, considering your name's in the goddamn title.
Well, for many years, I think that was not the case. It probably did turn into that. But yeah, anyway, so we were still living under those constraints, but then also like little kids and all that stuff.
Yeah,
so I was sort of like trying to cobble together my own homegrown MFA in theater and which probably maybe I learned more doing that way. I don't know. I really had to be active about it. So that's what I've been doing. But, you know, the theater, I don't know if it's how it compares to TV or film in terms of how long it takes a person average to emerge.
Yeah.
But it seems like it takes an average of a decade for someone who's working constantly. Sometimes there are exceptions to that, obviously, like, you know, and certainly historically there have been a bunch of exceptions to that. But it really takes a long time for someone to gain any kind of traction.
And break through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even just in that industry. Forget like the public. So
yeah.
So I've been an emerging playwright now for quite some time, and whether or not I'll actually emerge, I don't know, but it's been fun trying.
Yeah, I see. That would be, I just don't have the
patience,
and the attention span. It's like, in a way,
I don't know that I do either.
When I've written pilots and then get notes and back, by the time it's time to really then work for the pilot to be passed on and sold to somebody, I'm done with it.
Yeah, right.
I'm no longer even interested in it because they've just kind of needled you to death on it. And I just, you know, and then I end up getting be like, you know, if there's too many notes, I'm like, fine, screw it.
Never
mind. You
know,
whatever. I don't even care anymore. I'll show you.
Like, right.
Yeah. Way to go, Andy. You really showed them by not caring about your own project.
I had a friend who used to say, I'll show me.
Yeah.
One of those.
Yeah.
But so that daily product really does have its upsides of what you guys did.
Oh, absolutely.
It's like, Conan, you say we're making pictures in the sand.
Yes.
And that to me is terrifying because it takes me so long to figure out what I'm doing and to get it to the place where I'm happy with it that I need it to be a little bit more indelible. I need it to feel like maybe someone will perform this more than one time, that this will have a life in a different age.
Yeah.
Maybe. Don't know if any of it will, but
try. You get, I mean, again, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's kind of suited to my personality. Mm-hmm. Like when I started working freelance, I liked the different faces, different places aspect of it. And so that's why, you know, like being on one show for all of those years was not something I would have
chosen.
Yeah, probably chosen, but also just like I wouldn't have pictured that for myself.
Right.
And like the metaphor I always use is we're laying tracks for a train that you can hear coming. Like it's it's like just over that hill. We better get these tracks laid.
Right. You can't overthink it.
Yeah,
which is
kind of a blessing in that sense. And coming back to work on The Tonight Show with Conan was, you know, I had, you know, I left – in 2000, and I had a very kind of like, I got to go out into the world and see what I can do on my own because, you know, I mean, One of the remarkable things about the two of us working together is that it's very difficult for people with similar skill sets to sit next to each other and do the thing that they do
differently.
Yeah, differently. And, you know,
but especially in concert.
In concert, especially, like, you know, it's like having two lead singers.
Yeah.
You know, it's just it's
Anne and Nancy Wilson, although one of them does play the guitar.
Right. Exactly. So. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and he plays the guitar, but he's also like the lead singer. So but, you know, I mean, it's remarkable that we got through that. But that's also too, like, I think I needed to go away and do some other stuff. But the main thing when I came back, it was like, I can think of something in the morning and it'll be on TV that night.
That's pretty incredible.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Nobody gets that. I mean, such a small percentage of people get that. And, it, you know, and it might not matter to you. Like, if you're.
I'm an overthinker.
Yeah.
So for me, it's like terrifying.
Right.
And I'm thinking too of, like, now anyone listening to this who's, you know, dealing in YouTube at all is like, why wait till tonight? Like,
yes.
It's just now. It's just happening as it's happening.
Absolutely.
Which terrifies me. I can't even tell you how much.
Well, that I'm just, I'm just too old to, I still am living an analog kind of, that just the structural nature of television and entertainment to me is just antiquated.
Right.
Because somebody that's like far more successful than me is on YouTube, and I'll hear, oh, they're on YouTube?
Right.
Like, gosh, a small time. But it's like, no, dummy.
That's the mainstream.
That's what's happening.
That's the big time.
Yeah, yeah. It's
or TikTok, really.
Right.
Now.
I know.
I can't even keep track.
I know. And there's so many things that I'm just like, how do you make money at that? Where does the money come from? I mean, podcasts, for that matter.
Terrifying.
Like, you know, when people sell podcasts for gazillions of dollars. I mean, how does that happen?
Has anyone checked to make sure it's profitable?
Is there really that much money in
go back to advertising.
Yeah, yeah.
Advertising.
Again, but I mean, but it's like, are they selling that many socks?
Yeah, you know, I don't know.
Okay. God. I trust that it's something there.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about the new podcast.
The new podcast is
what's it called?
It's called Significant Others, and it's historical. And which is right on brand for Team Coco. It is not comedic.
Well, but they need to branch out too, you know?
Yeah,
sure, why not? So, you know, stretch the brand a little.
I'm feeling badly though for the people who like just followed because it was a Team Coco property and then we're like, when's it going to get funny? But anyway.
Yeah.
So it is telling stories of people who have been sort of overlooked historically, like especially people who were closely related to someone who was of significance. So Vera Nabokov, for example, who saved the manuscript of Lolita from the trash, her husband was going to burn it twice.
Oh, wow.
And she was like, no, we're keeping that. And she was massively important in his life overall. And they have a fascinating story. So, or Mary Lincoln, I think, is out next. And that was actually Conan's suggestion because and I was like, I mean, everybody knows Mary Lincoln. And
yeah, she's cuckoo.
Right. And he was like, no, but she was actually really formative for him in the early years. They were quite a, like, he may not have been president if he hadn't been married to her, which I hadn't known.
Yeah.
So, and she had a lot of connections to the South, which helped him. So, so it's just 8 episodes this season. They're all along those lines, not all spouses, not all, you know, stories of the woman behind the man. I didn't want it to fall into that trope or just like, oh, you know, we're revealing that this person's actually secretly been an asshole all this time. Like, there's some elements of that. Sure. You can't avoid it. But that's not the point of it.
Fun.
Right. Yeah. Well, it can be very fun. So yeah, that's it. And we have great people who are voicing the subjects for us, like Nick and Megan did the Tolstoys.
Nick Offerman and
Megan Mullally.
Yep.
And Dan Bukatinsky did Vladimir Nabokov, and Darcy Carden does Vera Nabokov.
Oh, wow.
And Lisa Kudrow does Elia Kazan's wife. And there's some other fun, Jack McBrayer's in there a little bit, you know, really great people. We were very lucky to have so many lovely friends. I'm taking all the friends that Conan has needed and then gained over all this time and just using them.
Yes.
That's essentially what I'm
doing. That's the world. Welcome to podcasting.
Yeah.
I love leaving the house these days. So
we can do it over Zoom.
I'd do it
at home.
And can we do it here?
We can also do it here.
Yeah, let me get out of the house. Well, that's great. And is it, I mean, how long does each episode take you to write? And how are they half hours? Are they hours?
The episodes are between 30, 40 minutes.
Yeah.
And then the follow-up.
That's the sweet spot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the follow-up episode is usually 25. And I don't even know how long they take me to write because they take me so long to write.
Oh, yeah.
I thought when I first talked to Adam Sachs about doing this, I thought, 6 months to do them all, maybe 9 if I'm really going to be persnickety. That was a year and a half ago. Mm. It has been a bit of a hair shirt, but all of my own making. So they're very labor intensive.
Yeah. That's why I like this podcast is just chatting because I can't. Homework?
No,
like, why would I sign on for homework?
I literally was like, I have assigned myself 8 essays, long form essays that for no class, no degree, nobody's ever going to care. And why am I doing this? I don't know.
Yeah. That's you got to do something.
You got to do something.
Yeah,
that is true.
You got to do something.
Yeah.
So. Well, anything else on the horizon for you, like besides, getting the kids out of the house?
Get rid of those two. Get them out of there. You're an empty nester halfway.
Pretty close. Yeah. My daughter's 16, she doesn't live with me full time because of the divorce. Will's.
He went going, and then he came back.
He's back here, but he lives in an apartment. He's 20 minutes away, but I might not see him for 2 weeks.
Right.
I mean, we'll text and so forth.
I feel like
but
that in the house sometimes.
Sometimes.
Our daughter sleeps so much.
Yeah. I definitely am starting to kind of feel like, well, okay, you're just going to.
Do your own thing?
You're just going to be a big old grown-up adult person and go have a life. And
I know.
And then I try to remind myself, how much did you want to talk to your mom and dad when you were 21?
Right.
How much time did you really want to hang out with them?
Right. No, they got to push off the wall.
Yeah.
They got to get away. But then they come back is what I'm told.
So. I'm hoping. Yeah, I'm hoping. So my girlfriend has a 2.5-year-old.
Oh.
So I have a 2.5-year-old in my back pocket just to keep me young, which is there's a lot of like, oh, yeah, this. Oh, yeah, right. I remember this.
Yeah.
But it's also like
it's kind of great.
It's fantastic. I mean, I love her. She's the sweetest and she's smart. But she also, too, there is something to these. Like there's been no hammer,
right?
And I'm now becoming the hammer.
Oh, interesting.
I'm the one that's like, and I'll, she had a big freak out the other day because I wanted her to hold my hand as she's crossing the street and a car is coming and she wants to do it or she wants to walk on her own and then has a freak out.
Yeah.
And, I'm saying to her, and this is something my ex-wife used to say to me when they were little, because I always would like reason with, I'd say like, you can't do this because of that.
Right.
And she'd be like, why are you even bothering? I'm like, it's for me.
Right.
It's more for me than for them. But I'm like, there's some day where it's going to break through. And I still kind of believe that. But like, I'm telling her, I'm like, you're not in charge.
Right.
It's not good for you to be in charge.
They don't
yeah.
Be in
they.
Charge.
I mean, I'm sitting there saying this to a crying 2.5-year-old. I mean, I'm not yelling at her or anything, but she has not had. She's not. She like the limit has been always a little bit fungible, a little bit like it can be pushed and pushed and pushed.
Right.
Whereas I'm like. And
hard line.
Yeah. And my girlfriend, she's had her single, she's raised her on her own. And the first time I ever kind of interceded in anything, my girlfriend, after after it was over. And I said, was that okay? Do you mind that? She's like, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. She's like, do it. She's like, that was sexy. when you said, you know, enough, you're going to bed.
It's a very different energy.
Yeah.
No, and you need, yeah. I mean, you need both. And
yeah.
I can't do the stuff that my kid's father can do.
Yeah.
And
that isn't to say that it's irreplaceable, you know.
True.
That,
like, no, people
two
get
two women
through.
Can't or two men can't.
Well, I mean, I think that there are different energies involved in all, you know, all those different relationships. It doesn't have to be on gender lines, but we happen to have a fairly traditional setup.
Yeah,
It took me a while to appreciate the difference rather than just trying to stiff arm him and do it all myself.
Yeah,
know,
yeah.
And now I'm almost too reliant on it, I think. Now, go talk to your father.
Go talk to the warden. I'm just the occupational therapist.
I just make all the food you love best. That's all I do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the third of these three questions are what you've learned. The advice, the epithet. No, not epitaph.
The epilogue.
Epitaph. That's what I meant. You know, the thing on your tombstone.
Oh, my God.
Because, you're going to have money for lots of letters. So you can make it long, too.
Can it be like motion picture? Can I have like a...
Absolutely.
Like a little run. A gif?
I bet you that's already happening.
Sadly,
I bet
I'm
you there's
sure
like,
right.
you know...
No, I don't believe in. I mean, more power to anyone who wants to do whatever they're doing. But for me, I sort of am into the like scattering and the disposing of
yes,
the
me too.
Physical form. And I read this book about Skyberry. Well, it wasn't a whole book about it, but I was reading some book. I think it was about witches, which was for a TV pitch that went nowhere.
Yeah.
The stuff you cram in your mind to try and make something happen, for no good reason. But they were talking about, I think it's called sky burial. Have you heard of this?
Mm-mm.
Where they put the body under some sort of mesh so that birds can come and pluck out the parts and distribute them. And it's sort of like a natural decomposition process that's open to nature, but not so open that it's problematic because I think there's some...
It causes a health risk or something.
I think so.
Yeah.
It gets spread to the wrong places.
Right.
Chunks. I don't know, whatever. But I was like, in a very unsentimental way, that sounded very interesting to me.
My feelings about what to do with my body after I'm dead is like, don't waste any real estate.
Right, absolutely.
Although I've always told anybody who might have occasion to be in charge of it, you can do, I mean, I'm telling you what I want, but you can do whatever the fuck you want. I won't be here and I won't care, if you want to, feed me to polar bears. That actually, like the notion of becoming protein for another living thing, that I'm like, okay, that makes sense. That's good.
Organ donor, great.
Yeah, mine right now is just, burn me up and dump me into water somewhere.
Right.
That's fine. And then you can go to the water and look and
sure.
say, yeah, there's... There he is. He's in there somewhere. But anyway, aside from not wasting real estate with your remains,
that's my highest ambition.
What's your motto?
Oh God, I'm very bad at this kind of thing.
You don't have to be good at it.
Let's see. I mean, one of the things that I really like about the podcast, and that I hope people appreciate about it. That feels a little bit like an antidote to all of the crazier shit that we're all living through is that just this is the biggest oversimplification in the world, but like everything's complicated. People are complicated and it's become I think the human brain tries to look for shortcuts. Right. And so we're always trying to find, this person is good or bad. This political party is right or wrong. This candidate is good or bad. All that stuff are. You just want to be done with that decision making and move on to the next thing. And so you try and boil things down and everything gets oversimplified and then we all get into trouble. So I think I always try to stay very open to the complexity of everything and appreciating the fact that even though these great characters that I'm focusing on in history had difficult relationships with people who they took advantage of, you know, that doesn't mean that it was all awful, right?
Yeah,
and that
yeah.
they were products of their time and that we're products of our time. And I guess that would be it. Lately, I've been for some reason thinking, I think because I'm starting to have those like generational tension moments with my kids where they have a different perspective on a lot of things than I do just because of what they're growing up inside
yeah.
of. And I think we're all indoctrinated by our time.
Yes.
And I think that there's often a sense that I didn't have a sense of that until I got to be older. I just thought people are the same all the time. Just mm-hmm. keep making new ones and we're all living in the same world
yeah,
and whatever.
Yeah.
But it really
and there's some truth to that.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
but
we're still humans. We make the same mistakes.
But Mike, you know, I learn perspectives from my 16-year-old daughter that I would not know on my own and that I am ultimately happy to learn. Mm-hmm. It has sometimes been
difficult and painful.
Yeah, a real crabby process where
right.
I just, you know, and I mean, just social media for me was a lot of that. Like when people learning that things I did or jokes I made or words I used that's not right. cool anymore.
Right.
And at first being like, how dare you, which feels so like Margaret Dumont-ish, you
right.
know, and like when my daughter we're having, you know, we have had numerous discussions about gender and the complexity of the way that we address gender and sex now. And I, you know, there was a lot of like, who are you to question, you know, and I calmed down from that and I'm like, no, okay, let's sort it out. Right. And yeah, there's a lot. And also, it's like, it's not always just like right or wrong. It's like, right. well, no, that's what is now. That's what,
yeah.
that's what exists.
It's the world we're all grappling
yeah.
with.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think what I get nervous about is when with the great new perspective can sometimes come because when I was young, this is how I felt, and I think a lot of young people feel this way, that like you've cracked the code. You're the first one to figure this problem
yeah.
out. And there's sort of an for some reason right now, the newer perspectives can tend to get much more moral authority. And sometimes that's warranted and sometimes it isn't. Sometimes
mm-hmm.
it's just new language, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes it's language that's crowding out an older truth, you know? And you can be adding to the truth of it, but you don't have to negate the old truth. Anyway, I'm getting very esoteric now, but I think that I'm really excited about all of the new conversations that are being had on a big, big scale right now, but I get very nervous when they are oversimplified.
Yeah. Well, Liza, thank you so much for spending this time with me. And everybody, check out the new podcast, Significant Others. I will. I haven't
whether
yet.
You like it or not.
No, I will. I will. I haven't yet. And I'm excited to
I feel
do
like
so.
You're going to like it. I think you might find it very interesting.
No, I know where to find it, so I might as well.
And I think it's probably the right amount between, you know, here and driving home. Like, that was the goal, is like slot it into
yeah.
a drive home or a grocery shop or making dinner.
Andy Daly told me that they did that 35 minutes is the average commute, so that's like
there you
a
go.
Good spot for the average
perfect.
Podcast. Yeah,
because I think we're in there, right?
Yeah. No. We're yeah.
Not this one.
Not this
no,
one.
Mine.
No, this one. This is
off the rails.
This is a meandering.
It.
Well, I used to when I first started this thing, it could be like an hour and a half, an hour and 45 minutes, and I always told myself, no, so many podcasts are too long and too meandering, and I try and keep it tight to an hour now, which we haven't done, but you know. We got on
you
some
know what?
Tangents.
We can trim some fat. I have some ideas.
Maybe. Or maybe just, you know, listen to this in two goes, people. Well, again, thank you, Liza.
My pleasure.
And thank
Thanks
all of you out
me.
There. Oh, I'm happy to have you. And all of you, I'm happy to have you listen. So come back next week and listen to some more.
I've got a big, big love for you.
The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It is produced by Lane Gerbig, engineered by Marina Pais, and talent produced by Galitza Hayek. The associate producer is Jen Samples, supervising producer Aaron Blair, and executive producers Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson and Cody Fisher at Earwolf. Make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.